Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 26th of October. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Callum Somerton.
Callum Somerton. I didn't expect you here. How's things?
Bet you didn't. Yeah, not bad.
So autumn, clock's gone back, gained an hour. Everyone had a good weekend thus far. What have you done with your extra hour in bed? I know, Kev, they probably don't go back until, is it another 2-3 weeks? But Callum, how do you find these times?
Don't spend it in bed. You've got to get up and out. It's nice.
Up and at 'em.
That means that the UK clock's now only 1 hour for me. So that means I have to get up an hour earlier, which is very, very
difficult. You'll be online, yeah. You hate that as well, don't you?
Yeah, but our clocks go back, I think. I don't know when our clocks go back, actually. I must check. It must be soon.
It's usually like 2 or 3 weeks behind, isn't it? Lagging or something like that. But
yeah.
Good week good. So far. What have you been up to, Kev?
I've just been working constantly, to be honest with you. Everything's very busy. There's lots of things going on. I think there's going to be, you know, I'm expecting the next 8 weeks or whatever it is until Christmas, it's going to be hectic. I think there's a lot of news coming for a lot of companies, a lot of movement in the resource space for sure. I mean, we've seen gold hit highs, we've seen silver hit highs, we've seen copper starting to move up and down again. So, yeah, I can see a huge number of the companies. There's also stuff coming in the biotech region as well, I think, that's going to happen. You know, we've got IMI Pharma should have some news, Savanna should have some news. So, yeah, it's going to be a really busy time. I think it's going to be hectic.
Absolutely. Let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. Obviously, it's all eyes on Trump and Putin after this, you know, much-hyped diplomatic back and forth we've seen. There was a planned meeting in Budapest, which looks like it's been called off, but tensions are rising again following their recent phone call and obviously the Alaska summit we saw earlier in the year. I think it looks like Putin got what he wanted from those talks. You know, the US agreed to pause the deliveries of these medium-range Tomahawks to Ukraine, which was one of Zelensky's biggest requests. It's giving Putin a small kind of diplomatic win. He's no longer quite so isolated and has regained a measure of recognition, even though the sanctions relief he wanted didn't materialise. Obviously, we saw Washington double down with these sweeping new restrictions on Russian oil, making a sharp turn towards pressure rather than engagement. It's a clear case of diplomatic give and take, a tit for tat, and it sets the tone for what could be the next more complex phase of this geopolitical standoff. So, you know, we saw obviously the ceasefire holding in Gaza earlier on, but what do we make of this whole kind of Trump-Putin, this Russia-Ukraine? He wants a ceasefire there, as all of us do, but it does feel like Putin is just playing around.
So what do you think, Alan? Give us your solve the world answer.
Yeah, I think it's obviously very complex. Clearly, you know, if you look at actually Russia as a world power, you think their GDP is very low. It's a very poor nation for the most part. But this really is a resource battle, right? Putin wants land. He wants to, you know, say that he has got a bit of the Soviet Union back. Ultimately, that's his sort of the political standpoint. But on a wider level, if you kind of put that to the markets, it's all about resources. You know, Russia is filled with natural resources. It has enormous, you know, wealth in the ground. And however this turns out, it's going to, you know, enrich someone. Maybe that's China. Maybe that's the States.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's a lot of talk about it being about, you know, just land in Crimea, but you're absolutely right. A lot of people fail to acknowledge that this is about minerals and land. You know, they're the two primary things, mainly the minerals. You know, you're not fighting over, there was always talk about why did we want to go into Iraq? Well, we know Iraq is one of the largest producing oil, you know, especially around the Kurdistan region. But I think that people do neglect to acknowledge that this is talk. It's about the mineral resources.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a resource war for sure. I think most of that are happening or likely to happen in the next while are going to be about resource. I mean, they said that, you know, there was wars fought over gold, there was wars fought over oil, you know, and I think Colin Bird has said in the past there's wars being fought over, the future there might be wars fought over copper, it might be rare earths, it might be, you know, all of these things that the Chinese are holding on. And to your point, Callum, I think there's only one winner in this, and the winner is China. You know, the resource control that they're going to have in the world, especially when now Russia is effectively their onside buddy, is going to be phenomenal. I think the US is scrambling now to try and protect their resource trade lines, if you like.
Yeah,
And
sure.
it's going to cost them money to do that, but I think, you know, they're going to have to do it.
The US is clearly looking for resource somewhere. We've obviously had the dispute with Russia. They're looking at what's happening in the Middle East, but then critically, look what they've been a bit quieter about. You know, they're talking about Canada, they're talking about Greenland, and then they're looking south to, you know, the rest of the Americas and thinking, you know, how can we muscle in on this action by restricting and removing support for all of those South American governments? So they're looking for something.
Yeah.
Who's been renovating this week?
No
Anyone?
idea.
The East Wing of the
East
White
Wing.
House. Yeah, the East
Oh, you
Wing.
mean
Did you see this
knocking down
that
the White House, you mean?
big
Did you see Hillary Clinton was criticizing him, and then somebody said, you know, you need to ask what your husband what he was doing in the White House. Never mind knocking down.
The one I heard was that his inter that somebody rang through and he picked up the phone, did Clinton, and it said, can you tell him to hold my calls and sack my cook? But he got the wrong message apparently. So, but yeah, I mean that's a very it's a major renovation. But I mean he's apparently funding it himself. That's everyone's come out and said, no, it's costing the taxpayer too much money. He said, no, it's all going to be. There's been a lot of backing. There's been a lot of donations. It's all going to be funded by his own money. I mean, like Roosevelt had in, I think, a bowling alley in there, didn't he, of his own? So it's not the first time that presidents have done a lot of kind of renovation at the White House.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to happen the next time a Democratic president comes in? Is he going to not use the ballroom when it's going to be the Donald Trump ballroom? Probably it'll be hilarious. What
So,
was that? What were they photographs? All the photographs of the president, and then he had Biden with an auto pen or something, wasn't it?
that's brilliant. So, Callum, I want to ask you one question because this is something that I've seen in the UK this week. Rachel Reeves proposed LLP tax reforms, which could impact around 200,000 professionals, including lawyers, accountants, and doctors, by aligning these partner tax treatment with that of employees through this employer-style NI contributions. The Treasury expects to raise about £1.9 billion a year by 2026 from the change, which would add an estimated £23,000 in extra tax for a partner earning around £300,000 and up 138,000 move from those on 2 million incomes. What do we make of that? How are they going to receive this news, do you think?
I think it's terrible, absolutely atrocious for a number of reasons. One is that actually, as much as when I was in the legal industry and working at Michigan de Rea, those partners at that firm were doing much better than that. But actually, there are a lot of law firm partners. People think, oh, law firm partner, they earn millions and millions. Well, a lot of them don't, particularly in criminal law and areas where we most need lawyers to give people representation. So they will. You know, take this news like a bucket of cold sick, basically, and it's not going to get any better from there. You know, this will materially impact how many people want to be in the industry. It'll materially impact the way that people set up their businesses. It will
Yep.
almost certainly cause these people who are all very clever and very good at structuring because they do it for their clients to go to Cyprus and to go to the UAE and elsewhere in the world, because why wouldn't you? You know, it's not evasion, it's avoidance, and it's sensible. But you know, I think we're in a position, and I won't get into sort of like direct political views, but who would be a lawyer? Who would be a doctor? Who would be a farmer? Who would work for a living, ultimately, is where we're getting. And the big
Yep.
piece that she's missing in all of this is that you can keep taking and taking and taking and squeezing the middle. But if you don't stimulate the economy, you might as well give up now. And they are doing as little as they can to stimulate the economy, in my view.
100% agree. And just picking up the paper here, the front page on the I today is Reeves in talk on 1p income tax rise, risking a Labour manifesto pledge to fill the 30. billion hole. The Chancellor has held to Treasury discussions on raising income tax with a 1p rise in the basic rate considered as she seeks budget measures to clear the 30 billion shortfall. Rees may also target additional or higher rates, but any increase in income tax would break a key Labour election manifesto pledge not to impose extra taxes on the working people. So not only is she going for the higher echelons and the 200,000 professionals in the accountants, doctors and lawyers, she may also be targeting the sort of lower end by talking about this 1p increase on income tax. So I think that Labour are absolutely doomed. I mean, let's face it, if there was another election now, looking at reform, I think it's a landslide.
I think it's a bit more complex than that. I think that the position for reform is that there's a lot of difference within that party. You can see the challenges that they had as between Farage and Rupert Lowe. You can see that there is a massive break between the top of the party, who have got individuals with some degree of sophistication, and the problems they're having now at grassroots level, where there are people who've gone into councils and don't know how to run councils. It's not to say that they don't necessarily have some good ideas. But when you are running an economy, you have to play to your strengths, and you have to use the leverage that you have. And, like him or loathe him, what has Trump done? He's used the opportunity to see that, America is the world's trading partner. They are a big power, to say, hey, pay us tariffs. And he's gone out and he's done that with, I think, quite a specific aim. It caused a lot of chaos, but it ultimately meant, if what he says is true this week, that they found an extra $31 billion sat in the Treasury from these tariffs. And what we've done is the inverse. We haven't played to our strengths. Instead, we have taken what is the UK economy, which is based on services. We are a services economy. The mines are shut. The manufacturing's gone. Jag Land Rover can't make engines that work. And so instead, what's happened is we've said, great, the bit that our economy depends on, the London city-based professional services, accountants, lawyers, yeah, we'll just tax them a bit more and send them elsewhere. So we've shot ourselves in both feet and tied our hands up.
Yeah, completely agree. Okay, so should we talk chill?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. We saw the company's latest business and strategy update this week, outlining just how far it's come over the past 12 months. Chill has evolved from an own brand CBD and vape operator into a diversified distribution and services group, now partnering with major global names across the FMCG and nicotine alternative sectors. The business has streamlined its structure, closed its costly US operations, established new warehousing and fulfillment facilities in the UK, and secured key partnerships with brands like RELEX and SIP Global. It's also preparing to launch Chill Connect, an online wholesale platform for independent retailers, while refining Chill .com as a focused stress relief and wellness marketplace. Today, we'll talk to Callum about how that transformation's been achieved, how the business model has shifted, and what's next as Chill builds towards scalable multi-channel growth. So Callum, your latest update, there's a lot of information in there. There's a lot of sort of changes and evolution for Chill, moving from an own brand model to this full distribution and services business. Just what was the turning point that made you shift direction, and how has that changed the company's outlook?
Yeah, so for us, it is a big change. And the reason that we've put out this update is that, there's a lot of information in here that people will have seen before, but people don't tend to read annual reports, and they don't tend to read those sort of reams of strategy information that sits within your annual report, your interim reports. So I wanted to take an opportunity to give the market an overview of what this business exists as today and why it's worth investing in. The turning point for us came in sort of autumn winter 2024. We had obviously come back to the market after learning of the disposable bans on vapes and things like that, and sought to put out our own reusable, rechargeable products. I spoke to people in the industry, some pretty significant people at some of the big tobacco companies who were working on products at the time where they had 40, 50, 60 million pounds behind them to go out and launch a new product. And to be honest, I didn't have that. Didn't have 40, 50, 60 million pounds. To be honest, at the time, we didn't have a bank account, frankly. So we were obviously still dealing with all of the chill issues. And so the view I took was, alongside others in the business and people that I've now built around me, if you can't beat them, join them. You repurpose that entire sales infrastructure, the network, the black book, the strategies, and use it to provide a service to other companies, to people in the FMCG space. And we have two, I suppose, points of difference. compared to other agencies. We built this agent, so we built this agency service or this offering, having seen the best and the worst of agency land. We'd seen the enormous costs that people are charged. We'd seen lack of execution. We'd also seen some quality execution too. We hadn't had it that bad. We'd managed to get into a lot of stores very quickly with Chill Zero. But we wanted to build an agency that effectively provides brands with direct access to convenience. It's often ignored in the UK distribution model. People think, well, we'll just dump it in a cash and carry and hope that store owners see the product and buy it. Spoiler alert, they won't. And we also wanted to give these brands a long-term view. It's no good to come in, charge your clients loads of money in 3 months, 4 months, and then move on to the next company. I would far rather have more clients at a lower rate each that gives us breadth, that gives us more things to talk about in the store environment, but also that allows us to stick with brands as a good faith partner all the way through their journey. You know, the real opportunity for us is, yes, in some of the huge brands like Elf and Relex that we work with, but also in the challenger brands that we deal with. It's the people that we take on, and they maybe don't pay as much, and they don't get necessarily the Rolls-Royce, all the bells and whistles service package. But if we get it right and we show them some value and they take some consultancy from me and my team and we build with them from day one, a good chance is that one of those brands will blow up and do extremely well, and then the rising tide will carry us as well. So that's the sort of points of difference. That's really what this is meant to be. And I suppose getting back to it, I said, what is the investment case for Chill as it exists today? It used to be that people wanted exposure to the vape industry, or they thought, hey, look, this is a sin stock, whatever they call it. Let's go for it. That's still the case. But it's more so that if you think about, a basket of stocks, you think about an ETF or something like that. You know, people buy into those. People buy into Bitcoin treasuries even because they want exposure to an asset that they may not otherwise buy themselves. And I take the same view with Chill. If you want exposure to venture companies, FMCG brands, consumer product brands that are extremely high potential, but also relatively high risk, you don't want to play around with SEIS, EIS, and you also want exposure to those huge mass market global brands that aren't available for you to buy because they're private, the likes of Elf, the likes of others that we deal with. That's why Chill is a solid investment case in my view. We've still got a way to go. We've still got things that we need to sort out, but we are able to offer investors exposure to all of that opportunity in the consumer goods space with the biggest brands in the world, but the highest potential brands in the world as well.
Yeah, how just explain how they would get exposure to those. Obviously, you've brought in these major partnerships, but how would an investor in Chill get any exposure to any potential upside in those companies or partnerships?
Our performance, our revenue, our EBIT, I suppose to say it plainly, our profit, our success is based entirely upon what we are able to achieve for our brands, how big we can grow our network, how good our market intelligence is, but predominantly the performance of the brands we support, both the ones where we buy their products and sell it, and the ones who pay us a monthly fee and a commission for the services, the consultancy, and the execution that we provide. So the exposure there is, yes, through the Chill vehicle, through our equity. But really, it's that, okay, our share price should see an associated rise if the brands that we're representing succeed, because that will come necessarily with a growth in the sales line and also, an increase in profit.
Makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about this Chill Connect rollout. Just tell us a little bit more about, the pivot to Chill Connect, and how will that sort of wholesale platform change the way you reach these independent retailers? What potential impact could it have on these sales volumes?
Yeah, so I spoke about how it's often ignored in the UK retail distribution space, this direct to convenience model. What I mean by that is that for a lot of brands, when they come into the market, they do a couple of things. They try and cobble together as much money as they can to pay listing fees, and those listing fees will let them get into the big guys, the Morrisons, the Tescos, and others. And that's not where your product is discovered, in at least the vape category, probably the alcohol category and others. Maybe for consumer grocery staples, it's different. But in these nascent categories, you're not discovered there. You are discovered, as I've said before, where someone goes to buy their bread, their milk, their newspaper. Maybe that's a bit old-fashioned, but the analogy works. And you need to be in the convenience store because it's at the corner shops and in the local grocers. where people actually discover products and you get the opportunity to get a brand into a store which they wouldn't otherwise have. So direct to convenience is very, very important. The brands that typically try and do that, they go to a cash and carry, they put their products in Booker, again at quite significant cost. They put their product into other places or they sell it to a distributor and they hope that two things happen. One is they hope that that distributor protects their value chain, doesn't think, oh, this isn't selling quick enough, let's just drop the price, because that kills brands every single time. You cannot destroy the value chain because it is very easy to reduce your price and impossible to increase it when you're a new brand. Separate to that, what it doesn't do is educate the retailer or the punter who's actually buying the product on why they should, buy into that brand, that proposition, that product. You have to go out and you have to explain, particularly in complex categories like vape, why the margins on that product are good to a retailer, why they should back you, what new flavors you've got coming down the track to keep novelty in the environment, what point of sale materials they're going to need to actually make it transact in store. You don't get that interface between a brand and a retailer unless you have individuals on the ground doing it in store. You can't just throw it onto the shelves of your local cash and carry and hope that when the corner store owner goes there on whatever day of the week it is that he takes out of his business and losing money because of it, that he actually chooses that one. He will choose the staples and the ones he knows. So the whole value proposition is that in direct to convenience, we provide a service which gives brands that direct interaction with convenience stores, which are the backbone of British retail. Where that sort of nexuses over to our wholesale app, our portal, our platform, is that, and again, I'm not going to pretend this is something particularly clever on a technological basis. It's not. It's a wholesale ordering platform. But because of the rest of our infrastructure and because of the rest of our model, it allows brands to sell direct to the convenience retailer. It's great for chill because that retailer who might have seen us selling, I don't know, an Elf product, an UBS product, and other clients will also see lots of other brands on there. And there's a good chance they'll buy, increase the basket size, and that's, of course, good for chill. But it's great for the retailer because it gives them a direct delivery to their store of what is effectively a cash and carry standard business. We can help to recommend and guide them and shepherd them on products that are coming through the works, new brands, new products, new categories. And it also gives us the opportunity to expand our range in a direction that, look, we can't afford, nor can any business, to have every single product in the world, maybe other than Amazon, sat on the platform, but also represented in person in store. Our reps don't have big enough car boots to stock every single product we've got now, let alone if we increase our SKU count by another 3, 4, 5,000 products. But what they can do is shepherd people towards this platform that's convenient, that's cheap, and that ultimately gives them access to the products they need when they need them without having to shut their store and go to a cash and carry. So that's why we see opportunity there. It gives us lots and lots of levers to pull in terms of trade B2B marketing. And it's exactly how we are going to take the foundations of this business, which I think are very strong, and scale it.
So, from the point of view of the things that you've just been saying, your guy goes to the convenience store. He has certain products available with him and also has a catalog. Is that basically what you're saying? So, if the convenience store wants to buy XYZ, he can literally go to his car, bring them in, and that's a cash sale that's done or a transaction that occurs.
That's correct. We've got a couple of different sort of operating models in a sense that all lead into our central operating model. So you have brands that opt for an exclusive team. Those exclusive field sales representatives are only repping that brand. In fact, they wear a uniform with that brand on. We are providing a pure sales service at that point. They take the strategies that we develop with them, the advice that we give them on point of sale material, and they take our team, and they don't then have to hire their own team to do this. So they'll pay us a monthly fee. Those guys will go in and they will buy, well, they will, take the product that we've bought and sell it to those convenience retailers, and they will get it out of their car and give it to them. If it's over a certain volume, then we will deliver it to them next day. You then have our non-exclusive teams that are going into these stores. They are effectively taking a basket of goods, a catalogue, if you will, as you say, and selling them to the store. And if they, want one, then they get it out of the back of their car. But on a wider level, look, we can't do that forever because our product count is growing so much that the reps just cannot carry all of those products. And so instead, those non-exclusive team members will instead go into stores. They will take hot products from leading brands that get those retailers hooked and into our network. And then they will push them towards our wholesale platform. And when they are on that wholesale platform, they will see the full breadth of goods that we offer. The rep will guide them. They'll talk to them about their needs. What are your customers like? Are they price driven? Are they quality driven? What does it look like? And then they will have the opportunity to buy whatever they want, whenever they want, for next day delivery from our platform. So that's the way that these transactions work, in essence.
Okay, very good. So I suppose people need to see an overall view of where the financials are going to come from in Chill. We've got chill.com. We've got what you've described already in terms of the Chill Connect. What else can we expect from Chill?
Yeah, so as things stand, you're right. You have chill.com. That is something that's, growing in the background. There are various projects, as I articulated in that RNS, that are ongoing at the moment that are really quite interesting. We are niching that site down into a more focused part of the wellness industry. It's stress relief, it's, things that associate with chill quite well. And Kev, that we've got kind of different marketing initiatives that you've seen going on that could turn this thing on, which is really what it needs. But park chill.com for a second. You've got the Chill Connect revenues that come from two direct streams. You've got the brands that are paying us their monthly retainer fee, and that monthly retainer fee is designed to cover all of our staffing bill, and we're there. So the reality is, we're in a position where brands are paying us to give them that execution in field, and that's revenue, and there's some margin there. Beyond that, we have brands where we are buying and selling their products. I have a significant amount of product in market from one of our biggest partners at the moment that we have purchased that we will sell. And effectively, that's where the bulk of that growth is going to come from. We are a traditional distributor in the sense that we make margin on the sales that are there. However, beyond that, there are other services that we will provide. I talk about in that RNS that we will provide a trade compliance team. The trade compliance team will be going into those key accounts, making sure that the products are merchandised properly, that the retailer's upholding their end of the bargain on the slotting fees, and effectively that the product has an opportunity to transact in the stores. That again is another monthly fee that we'll be taking from brands. We're already in discussions about that. And once you're into those convenience stores, but also the key account stores, the supermarkets, and you're providing that service, your leads list is every brand that you see on the shelf. Every single one of them is paying for the most part to be in those stores. And so if you can get, a modicum of cash from them and actually grow in that way, there is a hugely scalable revenue stream for us sitting right there, alongside things like marketing activations, sampling days, POS. We're working on monetizing the consultancy arm of the business at the moment, insofar as that me, my senior team, people like Connor, our head of sales, are providing an enormous amount of value in that consultancy because we've been there, because we've done it for our own brand and for these other brands. And so there are multiple ways to turn the taps on in terms of money into this company. We're working very hard to get them going. And of course, there's always going to be outflows like buying product and inventory. Cash flow as opposed to cash is always the challenge. But I'm not remotely concerned that this is a business we can take to profitability and beyond.
Very good. So that's, I suppose, the next point is from a financial perspective, how much of the overall Chill PLC costs, staff costs, et cetera, are going to be covered by all of these representatives effectively that are being paid by the existing company?
Yeah, there are three costs that affect this business, really. You have the costs of actually running the agency, if you will, Chill Connect, and that is your staffing costs, your infrastructure costs for the warehouse that we've opened in Hull, and similar things. That we are damn near clear on, right? It's not, ticking into profit immediately, but it is very close to being covered. And that has been the entire exercise in getting these clients signed up, in making sure that we are able to wash our face because, the clients understand this has to be a profitable business as well. They want a partner that's around for the long term and that is succeeding. So that's pretty damn close. You then have the inventory costs. Inventory costs are not the same. As I say, they are cash flow rather than CapEx. And the key there is making sure that we are not taking in too much, that we're not overexposing ourselves, but also that we're dealing with payment cycles and things, collecting, making sure that we're getting the money in from the retailers we've sold to. Park that for a second. Again, I don't see that as an issue for us per se, but it's difficult to manage. And then the final piece is the PLC costs. We're not yet in a position where, this is throwing off enough free cash flow to cover the entirety of the PLC costs. That's the simple reality of it. It costs a lot of money to be listed on the main market, the London Stock Exchange, in audit fees, in fees to the LSE, in fees to the FCA. I don't want people to be scared by that, though. This is a business that's here to grow. It needs growth capital to do it, sure, but it's not a company where there is spend flying out the door anymore on activities and territories that do not perform, that don't generate a yield, that don't get to a position where the revenue is growing in the right direction in a way that actually means something for the business. So all of this stuff runs to enterprise value.
What you mean is there's no cannabis smoking Americans taking lots of money.
Couldn't comment.
We can keep that in or not as you wish. Okay, so I know, and we can openly say it, I think, that we have a great connection with another company that Jonathan Swan's invested in, which is an off-market company. It's not listed yet, called Narwhal. And they're basically very well into AI in terms of helping you in terms of chill.com. How do you see that relationship progressing?
Yeah, I think it's early days for us. We're having those discussions at the moment. Where are the mutual opportunities, but critically, where are the opportunities for Chill? For the most part, let's look at chill.com. That site needs more customers. We need lead gen. We need ways of getting this thing out to a huge audience. And look, we're not in a position, or at least we haven't been in a position, to allocate loads of ad spend to it. You think about Goop, you think about health.com, you think about Holland and Barrett or Planet Organic. These guys have got enormous ad spend budgets, and we can't hope to compete with them. So we've got to growth hack our way there. How can we do that? Technology, the AI systems that Luke's got that he's building that we're working on together will do it. We have been running Meta ads for Chill over the course of this year. We will do more of that. We'll get it out to a broader audience. We're working on our first events and activations at the moment. We're going to be in various places in London and other major cities in the UK, actually getting this out in front of people. It's going to take money to make money on that site, but it doesn't necessarily have to be one for one. It doesn't have to be that we are, spending for ages to start seeing traction. This is an area of the business that was always going to be harder for us to achieve in because e-commerce is difficult and we're not an own product brand. But that doesn't mean we can't do it. And I'm pretty sure that the tools that Narwhal are developing will be fairly instrumental to us going forward.
Yeah, and there are products there that we've talked about in the past, and I'm happy to discuss them. Things like the vapes that allow people to stop smoking nicotine, having a process and things like that. So, are they still on the table, if you like, that you could create a product over, let's say, 6, 9 months, where somebody
Yeah.
subscribes, subsequently gets them off nicotine and then stop vaping, basically?
Yeah, I mean, those sorts of products, we've taken a view that nicotine and vaping products should not be on chill.com because it makes it radically harder to advertise. It means that you are banned from certain advertising services. It means that when I tried to set up our Google Merchant account without those products, they thought I was selling drug paraphernalia. It is very, very difficult in the vape space to actually run paid ads and so on. And it's going to become even harder to do that when the tobacco and vapes bill comes. Now, the last time regulation came to this industry, we had a lot of trouble. We had a disposable product, and the market, basically looked at it and thought, oh my God, how will this company survive? The answer is to be agile. The answer is to move. We now have lots of clients who've got shed loads of cash who are able to be agile and able to move. We represent them. We are partners to them. And it's not going to be a problem for us this time around. In fact, changes to regulation now are a huge bonus because we're able to foresee them, we're able to move, we've got a compliance agency that advises us, and we're able to take the opportunities to move in the right direction before the regulation comes, while a lot of the competitors are scrabbling around in the dirt trying to work out where they're going to get their next payday from. But in terms of, where that huge opportunity sits in an own brand chill product, Yeah, never say never. There are always opportunities, and we are pitched on lots of products all the time. I'm very careful with our cash now. I think I've always tried to be very careful with our cash anyway, despite various headwinds. But I think for the most part, look at the SIP product that we've spoken about before on the last time we were together. This is a cessation-focused product. It is a brand new novel technology. It'll be a patent-protected technology, but its whole focus is not to do what various unscrupulous vape brands have done, which is to perpetuate cycles of addiction, push people with nicotine salts deeper and deeper into their addiction. So they're using more and more than they were even when they were smoking cigarettes. It's to get people off. It's to give people that functionality that vaping and oral nicotine and these other categories were really meant to in their purest form provide, a way for people to get away from the harmful impacts of tobacco. Now, that's not to say that there aren't other functionalities. There's great data coming out at the moment that nicotine itself, as a compound, has enormous application in, the medical world as a means of stimulating the brain, stimulating individuals in a way that helps them to overcome things like Parkinson's and dementia. That's really early stage data, but I think we'll see more and more of it over the years. We want to be involved in this industry. It is far from a dying category, it's growing. And the critical thing there is that, yes, nicotine itself may be safe, but you've got to accompany that with a safe delivery method. And so things like the SIP product that we're working on, that we're right on, the ground floor with as it starts to take off, will be instrumental in shaping a new industry that comes out of what has gone before, which was this tobacco-focused, high sales environment. There's so much opportunity for chill. I'm sure at some point in the future there will be a chill product. But for now, we've got to sit where we are, keep growing and make some money, and not be in a position where we're betting the farm on a product which, is going to be, live or die. Chill cannot any longer be a business that is a moonshot. Yes, there are moonshots in the business, but the company's got to be more stable and more sustainable, and that's why we've built it in the way we have.
Yeah, you don't want to bet the farm because it'll be taxed for inheritance tax purposes anyway. So
Indeed.
you don't want to do that. From the perspective of moving forward, then, how are your competitors valued? Because now basically you are distribution for Elfbar, for RELEX, for, as you said, some of the smaller vape businesses. What sort of valuation, I suppose, revenue stroke profit do those companies have? Because that's what you're trying to aim at, obviously.
Yeah, look, the best comparator, and they're not a comparator to us, they are an absolute beast, is Supreme PLC, right? Supreme PLC's market cap's about £200 million at the moment. Now, Supreme has gotten to a stage where they're a mature business. They are valued on a multiple of revenue, they're valued on their EBIT. It depends which analyst you speak to is the best way of doing it. But look, these guys are big and they're scaled. And a company at that stage of its life that's been in the market for years and years has to be valued in a different way than a very high growth opportunity startup. And the reason for that is it's easier to go from 0 to 10 million than it is to go from 10 million to 200 million. That's just the simple reality of it. But they're valued based on their distribution network. And I'd suggest that there's an IP valuation that should be assigned to our distribution network. There is value in having the data and a direct relationship with thousands of stores. So that's something that should factor in. Our exposure to those big and challenger high growth brands that we've spoken about has got to be in there. And I think beyond that, we need to be looked at the moment this company's market cap is where it is. Because people see the risks, they see what's come before, they see that this category is a difficult one to succeed in. But we've succeeded and we have stayed alive and we've stayed on the market through some very, very difficult times. And now there should be, I believe, some opportunity priced. There should be a forward, sort of view taken that this company can go on to achieve. We have exposure to some of the biggest and best categories in consumer packaged goods. And that, I think, is largely ignored because it's a sort of bare view that this is all risk and that it's remote that we will succeed. I won't accept us failing. We have to make this work because of what we've been through. And so we need to look now at, okay, what has this business look, achieved in the last 6 months? It's come back to market. It's been suspended for long over a year and yet has been given a clean bill of health by the regulator. Tick. We've published our results. We're back on the market. We're done. We've got inventory financing. We've signed deals with some of the biggest companies in the vape market, Elf, Relex. We have challenger brands coming out of our ears that are wanting to launch in the UK. We are starting to annoy competitors who are many, many tens of times larger than us that are trading, north of 100 million pounds of revenue a year, who are now trying to run interference in terms of the sales teams that we have. They're putting their reps in locations where we've got reps. That's healthy competition. I back my guys all day long. But that's a good sign. So this opportunity, this potential, is currently not reflected in our valuation, and nor is the strength of the partnerships we have, because we are very close to a lot of very high growth companies, and those high growth companies are only going to get closer to us. So, whatever the value is today, I think it was Bezos who said at some point with Amazon, and I am not making a comparison, just to be very, very clear. But I think what he said was, everything was going right in the company, and yet the only thing going wrong was the share price. And it often is reflected in that way. The market doesn't understand the dynamics of a company that is on the up, because what it wants to see is it needs to, they want to see hard numbers. They want to see that revenue delivered. They want to see the contracts come to fruition the second after the contracts have been signed. It doesn't work in that way, but it will work. And that's what we're headed towards.
Yeah, no, I think well said. And from a cash flow point of view, RNS this week to say one of the legacy things was sorted out and you got £210,000. And it was quite obvious from the RNS you couldn't comment, so I'm not expecting a comment. But yeah, tell us something at least.
Yeah, look, like I say, company, particularly in 2024, went through this annus horribilis. We were in the worst of times. Again, be totally direct, it is quite astonishing that we managed to pull through all of that, because everything that could have been thrown at us was thrown at us. And the market doesn't even know all of it, frankly, and then nor can it. It would be inappropriate. However, we're through that. The fact that we succeeded here and that there is some recognition that, things went wrong and the company, should be set right in some sense is very valuable. And there are other battles for us to fight, but they are battles that don't come with the same levels of risk attached. In fact, they come with upside. And so, look, very happy to be in the position that we're in, very pleased to be putting the past behind us and to have dealt with it. And actually, to start focusing more on the business. We've been doing that anyway, but it'd be nice to have, Sunday 10 p.m. till midnight back. So there we are.
Very good. Very good. Callum, you're on the Sunday roast. We have to ask the question. What's happening in the Somerton household now you are a happily married man, and for the Sunday roast? Are you the cook in the house, or your good lady gonna do it for you?
I'm not the cook. I love to cook, but I don't really have the time for it. So she does a very good job of it. My preference is lamb, but yeah, can't.
Man after my own heart. Bit of mint sauce there with or not?
Oh yeah, you'd be rude not
Wrong,
to,
wrong
wouldn't you?
season for lamb, though, isn't it? We're now in autumn, and you should be sort of reaching towards some of the partridges hunting season. Do you
Yeah.
like any other game birds?
Wow. Yeah, I like birds. No, it. Dog. It's a dog walk. It's a pub roast and a pint, isn't it? So yeah, if you can get a pub that will do a bit of partridge, that'd be good.
Partridge in a pear tree. Very good. Right, Callum. Well, we look forward to speaking to you in the probably not too distant future as we continue to move forward with the story of, in inverted commas, the new chill. Because I think basically the company is fundamentally different than it was prior to all of these troubles, let's say. It's a fast-moving consumer company that is basically going to be distributing products on a large scale. And as that scale increases, then I think you should see the valuation will increase with that. So let's see if people buy into that future. And I still think chill.com has got an immense future ahead of it. It's just needs that marketing to get it moving.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, it's not the first time the company's been reinvented, but I'll lay my stake in the ground. It should be the last. So let's make it work.
Good. Thanks for appearing again, Callum. It's great to see you.
Thanks, gents.
Let's welcome our next guest, Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. Colin, there's plenty to talk about with two major updates out in the last month. The latest progress from the Silver King Copper Project in Zambia, and now the acquisition of the Hamgas antimony licenses in Morocco. At Silver King, the company has completed phase two drilling with strong intersections from both the main body and the new Kopje prospect, while in Morocco, Extract is moving to reinstate a former producing antimony mine, a timely move given how antimony has become one of the world's most sought-after critical minerals, with prices up sharply this year amid tightening supply and growing demand from energy storage and defense sectors. Colin, let's start with Zambia. Phase two drilling at Silver King has now wrapped up. Can you summarize the key results and what they tell us about the scale and continuity of the mineralization there, please?
I think that it's fairly well known to our shareholders and to good souls that Silver King started, it was the first mine ever in Zambia, and for silver, that's why it's called Silver King. So the place is written, well, riddled is probably an overstatement, but there are numerous adits, trenches, and small workings around the place. Magnetics work for us very well in finding new bodies, but cut right down to the chase that we started at the obvious place, as you know, and that was the breccia pipe. Not sure it's a pipe any longer because the shape gets more elliptical as we look at it. We did, we've always said that we've got to test this pipe to depth, and so we stepped out quite a long way to drill a very long hole to get to depth. And lo and behold, as we went, we got two intersections of good material. So whether they're feeders off the main pipe or structures that they don't know, so that put the wrap around phase one just for a bit of flavour. But we've got at least five targets. One we call the Worm to the north. It's a 2 or 3 kilometre presented environment, moving and twisting and turning. We have a Copy, which is a bigger granite hill, which has got veinlets in it, and to the most sides of that, we've got all sides of that, we've got evidence of continuous mineralization. The Copy has shown itself to be mineralized. It's veinlets, 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 and so we're trying to put that together. And that's more interesting, but it's more predictable as the Copy goes down towards surface. Right, if we were to mine that, it'd be more of a quite an open pit. To the north of there, we found conventional type mineralization up to 20 meters thick. Now, that is not your super chalcocite like you get in the main pipe. It's chalcopyrite with some chalcocite, but it's got all the potential visually of carrying good grades. And obviously, when you get thicknesses of 15 to 20 meters, you don't need too much strike before you're building up a pretty good ore body, so a sizable ore body. So we're pleased, very pleased with Silver King. We're trying to piece it together. That's not easy because there's different styles of mineralization. We say it's not Katumba because Katumba is only 11 kilometers away, and as you know, that's a big mine being developed by the Chinese. It's not Katumba, but then it's not the pipe either. So we're looking at pretty conventional mineralization spread over 15 meters, chalcopyrite with a bit of bornite, and we've got another pipe of a similar time near the Copy. So we're Phase two is just one of many phases which will continue as we build up, first of all, a knowledge, define continuity. I mean, the pipe to the north, sorry, the occurrence to the north I talk about wasn't really expected, anticipated part of the program. Just that the drilling in the Copy took us to that because that's where the direction and trend was going. So in these type of ore bodies, Phil, A sends you to B, sends you to C, sends you to D. And so we've got a group of a number of magnetic signatures which we're going to follow up. We're awaiting the results of the phase two program, and we're basically doing a sort of mine, not sort of, we're doing a mine plan to mine the breccia, because as you can imagine, so easy to mine, so quick to get into mining. And the plan, of course, now is to carry on the exploration and to work towards a developing a small mine with our partners, Cooper Lemon, because that's we live in a time now where I think we've got a market, gentlemen. I think we've got a market which has somewhat got exploration indigestion, and they want to see action. And across the board, that's what I'm trying to do. And there's absolutely no reason why this pipe, which has been defined, can't be planned as an open pit. And we get into business. We procuring second-hand kit is not a major problem in Zambia, and new kits as well. So I guess you can look at Silver King now in two parts. One is continuing exploration and definition, moving towards a much larger ore resource, and then, but more or less similar to other projects in our stable, starting a mine, because this cash flow is available at these prices. And there's the relationship the amount between the amount of cash you've got to spend and the results you get from the mine are so favorable, then why not get on with production? So our partners, Cooper Lemon, got on very nicely with all the aspects of bringing together a small mine, and we'll probably farm into that small mine. So that's the sort of action what's going off at Silver King. It's beginning to be a very focused project, and being very close to a developing mine makes it even more interesting to our, to the general mining community. So that's Silver King.
Yeah, I was going to say, because obviously, according to your RNS, you've hit that initial spend threshold under that JV with Oval Mining, which obviously gives Extract the option to increase its stake. How do you see that Silver King developing from there or from here? Are you starting to think in terms of resource model? I know you talked about a mining plan there, or even early development studies at this point. What are the next steps?
Well, I mean, it's really very simplistic now. You really can carve it into one and two. One is a small mine. Two is continued exploration, moving into definition, moving into resource. We still don't know whether it's a big mine or a, well, medium. It'll never be a really big mine. But will the plant that we're envisaging be sufficient, or will we have to expand the plant to be a bigger one? My own view is that we'll kick off the development, we'll work along nicely, we'll spend the next year, 18 months defining the ore body, and probably have to build a bigger plant. That's a forward-looking, that's a forecast, and which has got to be tested in practice. So let's just boil it down to is now a two-pronged attack. One is to get a small operation going, and two is to test all the anomalies, and there are still quite a number to test, and create a mining resource, be it totally connected, be it partially connected.
Colin, the scenario with Silver King, I think I'm not sure which major it was, but they did some extensive drilling there at one point, and then pulled out of Zambia as a whole. Do you see that this continued effort to go in after the majors is working for you, not just in Extract but in other companies?
Well, in actual fact, the fact that a major has left is no bad thing. In fact, it's been our policy to follow majors, because let's face it, you get an immense amount of raw data, which would cost a fortune. But a fortune is less, well, very important, but time is even more important. Take you 4 or 5 years to generate. And in my career, Kellenbeler, that was a certain company, a major company, that had 10 years there flat out with a very big team and found nothing. In 19 months, we got it sold for $265 million. And our stable in our portfolio of projects, we're developing a mine now, which again was left by the majors. Left in a different era, in a different time in the 70s, but nonetheless, we were left with a huge bank of information, 69,000 meters start. So if the majors leave, it's no bad thing, because they leave for different reasons, and they're not always technical. Well, not always, I was going to say not always technical. Very often they're not technical. It's, we don't want to stay here, or we want to devote our resources to Kazakhstan, to wherever. And that's happening now a little bit. A lot of money going into Kazakhstan, for example. So the fact that majors were there before, in actual fact, for me, is a good sign. And the fact that they didn't get continuity, and we proved continuity, is diligence.
Very good. So just going back to, I think it was Glencore who were in Silver King. I mean, we visited Silver King with Cooper Lemon. So we've walked around the property and seen literally the oxidized copper. And again, had it explained to us that there's the whole tunnel system already in there, where they were in the pipe, as you say, but maybe it's not even a pipe, maybe it's much wider than this in terms of the basin. But I mean, how quickly could that become a small mining operation, do you think?
Oh, very quickly, because the difference between big and small is all about permitting. Is all about regulations, and most countries, especially in Africa, but no, not around the world really, they the permitting of smaller operations far more favourably than they do larger operations. And this is based on giving the local community the you're working in an environment which is really working for a mining company is working a big license. The NGOs all over, everybody's all over. All of the processes take so much longer because the money numbers are so much bigger for small mining. And typically, of course, the equipment is smaller, so everything you do is more easy to put together and to get started. So I'm optimistic for an early start.
By early, what do you mean? I mean, we're talking 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 3 months.
We all know the regulatory framework in which we work, and that's a forward statement I'm terrified to make. But take it for granted, Phil, that we're flat out to in actual fact get towards production and to get towards a defined resource, so we can actually bring it to account at Silver King.
And what percentage are Extract going to hold of that as opposed to Cooper Lemon or the...
We're a minority in the small mining because it was never our mission. It was never our mission at Silver King to be miners. Never our mission. But we've taken the opportunity to enjoy what a small mine might bring in cash terms. And so therefore we'll back into their operation. And again... things aren't completely finalized, so I wouldn't want to say what final or the final ratios of ownership will be. But we're very, very just putting that operation going.
Yeah, you'll be a minority stake in something that will be obviously kicking off some free cash flow, and that's probably the easiest way to put it.
That's the easiest way to put it. We don't mind being a minority. We work well with Cooper Lemon, you know, wherever we work. And of course, they'll be drawing very much on our services. And we'll be drawing very much on their local knowledge and their ability to work small mines. So it's, you know, it is a marriage made in heaven, in actual fact.
Colin, I just want to turn attention now to Morocco and Amgas. As I mentioned at the top there, you know, we've seen the prices of antimony, you know, doing extremely well. Its price is up sharply this year and it becoming one of the world's most sought after critical minerals. You know, supply constraints, a lot of antimony is produced and, you know, held in China. So let's turn to Morocco and this new exciting addition. You know, what was the thinking behind acquiring the Amgas antimony license and what attracted you to the project's potential for early reinstatement of mine status?
Well, you know, we did this sometime last year and same old story that, you know, trying to stay in front of the market, Phil. It was no sort of secret and it was evolving quite fast that antimony supplies were pretty much confined to China. And as usual, China controlled the antimony market. Now, antimony, as you know, is used in immense all over the defense industry, whichever aspect of the defense industry, look at bullets, ballistic missiles, even uniforms. Antimony, anything where you've got to be heat resistance for certain components, and of course a uniform has got to be as heat resistance as it possibly can be, then antimony plays a role. So the need for antimony obviously is increasing, but equally the military use is well recognized, and in an unstable world that we live from a military aspect, to have antimony is pretty important, and the last place you want it to be probably is all stored in China. So that was recognized by our group, by our team, and we looked around the world, where is antimony not being mined, or has it been mined in the past, and where's the opportunity to get good sized projects. So off we went, and we did a really extensive due diligence, tramped up and down the place, and to our surprise, we found, you know, you might call them mines, but they were really rabbit holes, you know, artisanal mining. But nonetheless, when you went down there, there was quite thick exposures. Likewise, we saw quarries. They call them open pit. We call them very rough quarries being worked for antimony. And you could see that it had been worked in the past as well and abandoned because of the low prices of the past. But nonetheless, there's tremendous bodies of antimony ready for the off. Gas in particular fits the bill. There's an open pit, which quite frankly, we've got to trim back, make safe and expose for the next level of production. There's one tunnel, which has got to be rehabilitated and take advantage of open stoping opportunities. and we found geophysical methods to locate concealed antimony bodies, which we're using now and are identifying quite a few at Amgas. We got Amgas, and then some distance away, we got another cluster of deposits showing similar properties, but not. But of course, we've got antimony on the properties, but they've not been developed as gas as a mine. So gas is the obvious place to start. The Moroccans are very, very supportive, a very, very good jurisdiction to work in. And it's our intent there to... I'm nervous of intermediate products that, you know, at the moment you can sell as much as you like and without much problem. But it's been my past experience that as an intermediate product, when all of a sudden you get equilibrium in supply and demand, these intermediate products, it's not that the price goes down, Phil. You can't sell them. Nobody wants them. So we're moving straight away to a flotation plant. You might say, wow, flotation plant. All that means money to me. But in actual fact, with the size of these operations, you're talking about a containerized unit. So it's a screening plant and a containerized unit. So, you know, don't start thinking of your typical copper belt concentrator. Start thinking of something much smaller that you could put into two or three containers. And then, you know, the time to install them is probably no more than 4 or 6 months to get them up and running. And that will be the plan at Amgas, to, from a mining perspective, make the place safe, rehabilitate the mine, open up another, add it, and make the open pit safe. And obviously, open pit mining is always cheaper than underground mining. So first port of call will be to make the open cast safe. And by definition, making the open cast safe and starting the open cast, you will be opening up new adits where you find a sizable reef. So in a nutshell, it's a combination of, in one area, Amgascan, is we rehabilitate the mines and take in artisanal antimony as and when our flotation plant is built. And then in another part of Morocco, we'll be doing raw exploration where we think there's a chance for a meaningful open pit. But we're the only company, I think, on AIM who's in the antimony space. We Kevin, Phil?
Yeah, I think there is a sniff of it at Conroy Gold now, I think, about it as well in Ireland. But yeah, I mean, they're mainly a gold situation, but they've got antimony that was mined previously, a similar situation to you have in Morocco by the sounds of things. On top of the Clontibret asset. So there's only a couple, I think, maybe yourselves and somebody else. But I'm coming back to this, just for people who don't understand or don't know, it's a flame retardant chemical, basically, that is why antimony is a big thing, SP2O3. And it's also used in lead acid batteries, glass ceramics. But obviously the main end use in the last years has been as a antimonial lead and ammunition, and that's 43% of the market, flame retardant 35%, and non-metal 22%. So I suppose the big issue here is there hasn't been enough of it. Okay, now it looks like the actual demand for it isn't going to actually...
I don't think, Kevin, it's about enough. I think it's in the wrong place.
Yes, okay. That's the other thing that I was coming on to, that the majority of the places of where it is not in the US. Effectively, if we're being realistic, because you've got China, you've got Russia, you've got Kazakhstan, I think it is, or that places where it actually is, and that obviously causes a problem for the US, because basically isn't any there for the US to use or any other Western organizations. So I think a Western antimony asset in terms of something that could supply the US is going to be worth a lot of money. And, you know, at $51,000 per ton, which I think is roughly what it reaches, that's five times more valuable than copper is at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, there's, you know, it's a different volume market as well. But the States there, I think Trump and the government is actually injecting money into antimony concentrators and final product companies. And Kearney, I was told last night, Kearney in Canada, they're also looking to invest. So this is a great situation to be in. And, you know, we are talking to the companies in the West ourselves, in North America. So quite frankly, We're putting our stake in the ground in a very, very firm way. And we want to move to get that flotation plan going as fast as we possibly can, as fast as we possibly can, so that we're actually making a prime product for distribution. And of course, the best way of doing that, Kevin, is you don't go out into space with total risk. You form association with partners right now. And that's what we're trying to do. We're going around trying to find the right. It's not, are there any partners out there? Certainly there's partners out there. It's finding the right partner. And this time round, it's not about money. Of course, those projects, those little flotation cells, where there's change out of 1.75 million. It's not as though you're going out to build something which costs 25, 30, 35 million and 2 years to build. It's something which, you know, as I say, is in the order of 1.5 million and 6 months to build. So we put all our applications in, permit applications, and we'll be awaiting permissions to do what we want to do. And we've got a very, very clear plan in front of us. So it's not by accident again, and we don't chase ambulances. We saw this come in. We saw that the squabble over antimony. We saw that antimony was confined to the wrong places and production was coming from the wrong places. And we saw Chinese all over those places in Europe where a little bit of antimony was produced and buying it up in a fairly raw status and shipping it back to China. So if that doesn't evidence the opportunity, I don't know what does. And, you know, as always, we took it. And boots and all, we went in there and got our positions. We went into Morocco. I have to say, Morocco is an absolute pleasure to work in. The ministries are very supportive. The infrastructure is excellent. There's an underlying mining infrastructure who understands what we're trying to do. We'll be able to get the parts, the equipment that we need as well. So everything should move quite quickly. And we're open, and there's plenty of water around and ports. And so we'll be in a position quite quickly to, I think, get into production and to be a small feeder to a small market. You don't have, it's not a good idea to be to have ambitions to be a big feeder into a small market. That's never been my plan, Kevin.
Yeah. What sort of quantum would this processing plant do per annum?
I've been asked not to mention that.
Okay.
Because it's too early. They might, you know, often people just say what the plan's going to be and then go looking around to see if they can find enough ore to fill it. I first of all want to define the available ore for at least 8 years and then size that plant.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Right, now, just so people understand, the current market cap of Extract is around the £6.5 to £7 million mark. How much of the money from the gold project that you sold off is still set to come in?
Well, if you get the sulfide project and the balance of the oxides, I'm thinking you're looking about $7 million.
Okay. Now, obviously, with the price of gold at the minute, you would imagine that sulfide project is going to be pretty likely to happen. You would hope.
Well, look, anybody who's sitting on a gold mine resource now is sitting in a fairly good position. When it's refractory, which is the sulfide is, it's fairly refractory. Fine grinding isn't the only answer. You have to introduce other aspects of processing, and I'm sure that the group who bought the project off of us realise that. In fact, I'm not sure I know that they're doing all their own work and all their testing to see what the right processing solution is. And I've got no doubt in my mind that plus $4,000 in gold, they're not sitting around waiting to do that. And of course, that triggers a one-off payment as well when they announce the sulfide plan. So we're as keen on them as to find the processing solution. And that is a good backstop, if you like, to our treasury.
Yeah, indeed. Now, the $50 million, $60 million, $70 million, $80 million, $90 million question, and maybe it's sort of worth a lot more than that, I don't know where I came up with those numbers, is Bushranger.
Yes, Bushranger. Bushranger has caused a lot of angst in both with the management team and with our shareholders. And some shareholders are really, really disappointed in the outcome of the Bushranger project. But you know, we are second guessing nature, second guessing God, and the disposition of mineralization. The fact is, we drilled 34,000 meters, every hole except one, which was testing the eastern boundary, actually went through long runs of mineralization. Trouble is, a lot of it was 0.24. Had it been 0.35, it would have been a world-class ore body. Now, you know that the company is working on ore sorting, and ore sorting is the most advanced, quickly advancing part of our industry. And this does all sort. It does have the appropriate mass pull, and it can size up to 0.35. Also, within the ore resource base, 1.3 million tonnes of contained copper sits about 6 to 9 years of 0.62. So you're looking at a project there which doesn't quite pass muster, and yet the facilities there are there to make it work. You've got a 9-year start at 0.62. If you take a long-term view on copper, you'll get your money back with the 0.62. And if you take a really long-term view on copper, that you're in New South Wales, and if you take a political view as well as an economic view, that's one hell of a resource to have. And then look around Australia, there isn't one as big, discovered and explored and discovered and defined to York standards. At the moment, it's of no interest. Nobody's coming to us. We are making it known that we're prepared to monetize it, and we've been making it known that we're prepared to monetize it for a year now. But the environment for monetizing gets better by the day, doesn't it? So whoever looks at Extract and completely writes off Bushranger as a waste of time and a useless journey, in actual fact, are not quite being fair to the company, because we have 1.3 million tonnes of copper in Australia in a project which is completely open-ended for drilling and exploration. Now, if that isn't a good situation to be, I don't know. You might say, well, why don't you go out and do more ore sorting? Why don't you go out and finalise this ore body? There are more immediate things to bring cash to our shareholders, to bring cash to our group. You know, the ore has been there millions of years. We've got the permits. We're doing limited test work still on ore sorting. And so I am convinced, Kevin, that Bushranger will have its day and will be the next generation. Will be one of the next generation of big mines. Because I tell you what, tell me where the others are, because I don't know.
Yeah, Colin, I'm not even trying to add any value to Bushranger, but if somebody just came in, I'm not saying you'd accept this because I'm sure you wouldn't, but if somebody just came in and said, right, we'll pay Extract all the costs that they incurred to do all the drilling, and then we want all the information so we can carry on the project, how much money would that mean that Extract would receive?
Oh, you know, there wouldn't be much change as $12 million, would there?
Yeah,
I didn't know that straight off the top of my head, but that's almost making Extract a bank with no enterprise value, no risk value.
No, and I'm trying to make myself understand, you know, what has already been sunk into the ground in terms of that. You're talking about probably £8-9 million, and you know, subsequently, that's more than the market cap of Extract as we speak, and that's really the point I'm trying to make in the quantum of Bushranger. It has been a difficult time because obviously you know, the share price was massively higher based on the fact that people thought this could literally be sold for hundreds of millions at a copper price of $12,000 per ton. This is going to be sold because it's totally viable.
The break even's gone down to 10,000 now with all this test work we've done. So, you know, if one became convinced that you're going to be plus 12,000, there's a margin for a long, long time. And as I say, you know, when you look at a copper supply as we are now, it gets less about return on investment than availability of copper. And I'll reiterate, that Bushranger will have its day. I have no doubt about it at all.
Yeah,
it will be one of the next generation of large copper mines.
So to recap Extract, I'm going to recap it and you can agree or disagree. What we're looking at is a near-term production opportunity in Silver King with very nice quantums of silver per ton and extremely good copper grades, especially as it's going to be small mining. So you're basically going to be targeting the high-grade stuff. You've got the antinomy in Morocco, again, targeting small mining initially while you still have an exploration upside. You are also then in a situation where Bushranger could have a valuation in the future. We're not saying now, but in the future, to recoup what was spent and hopefully have an enterprise value. You have the potential to receive a further $7 million. And on top of that, we haven't even talked about it. You have some licenses in Zambia that are positioned in a very strategic position. So that's basically what we've got, and that is £6.5 million market cap as we speak.
That's correct, based on two very important commodities, copper and antimony. Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's a fair summary.
So I think that's the best place to leave it, Colin. I hope you're going to enjoy your Sunday roast this week. What is the Sunday roast in the bird household?
Sunday roast does not figure that much nowadays. I've been in the position where if I have a good Sunday lunch, it slows me down for the day, and you know, we don't want to do anything. So it's actually dropped out my regime now, so I don't do Sunday lunch. And you won't believe it, as daft as it sounds to me, to go to bed on a light stomach, just a pizza and chips. That's my way of enjoying Sunday. A good film, pizza and chips, and I'm an happy bunny and can wake up to fight the good fight on Monday. And as you know, we're fighting lots of good fights at the moment. So you've got to wake up full of beans on Monday. It's no good being sluggish from eating too much meat and half a bottle of red wine. So very, very modest now, and a light supper, and ready for the coming week.
Good, and I'm sure we're going to hear from you in the not too distant future about Byzance, about Galileo, about African Pioneer, about Kendrick, because I know you've been a busy bunny. So yeah, we look forward to hearing what's going to be happening with all those things in the not too distant future.
Yeah, well, we've heard about the London buses all coming at the same time. I think if you have a good look at our group, that's the situation. And I don't think it's caused as much by a change in market, which obviously helps somewhat. But in actual fact, just the way the projects have advanced means that the buses tend to be arriving at the same time. So we are a very, very busy team. But thank you for having me on the program and on the podcast. I do appreciate it. And hopefully for the rest of the balance of this year, we'll continue to give the market news and good news.
Very good. Thanks for coming, Colin.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. This one's going to be a bit of a blast from the past, Kev. Symi, at me, up 200% on the week after the trading suspension was lifted. We saw a flurry of trades. I was actually watching some of them go through, and it was incredible. The volume that was traded on the, I think it was on the Friday, was pretty impressive. But you look at the number, I was looking at the number of shares in issue, and we are at the 70 billion mark. I can't remember what there was when we were sort of buying in. In fact, that's one of the reasons that almost how the roast was born, wasn't it? Was the backstory, yeah. Was Supply at Me had an amazing run from the sort of 0.04 point roll away up to about 0.6, 0.7 pence, which was probably about a 15 bagger, if memory serves me right. And that kind of brought us together, and we were talking, and we'd have been in touch with Alessandro Zamboni, and we then obviously started doing the podcast. So just talk us through that. I mean, what do you think of Supply at Me? Do you think the business model will ever onboard all these companies and act as this kind of inventory expert?
I genuinely have no idea. I mean, I don't even know what the market cap is at that price, to be honest.
Well, they're trading at 71 billion shares and the market cap at 0.008. So they've dropped one, they've moved one decimal place to the left. So they're at 0.008 was the final trade, and they're at 5.9 million cap with 71 billion shares outstanding.
Yeah, so it's sort of a £6 million market cap. When it came back to market, it must have been around 2 or 3. So, I mean, if it works, it works. And if it works, it will make money. So, yeah, you just never know, do you? But, I mean, it's not for me, that's for sure. But
yeah, so they announced that they'd done an update, a funding update, in respect of the 5.15 million on-demand convertible funding facility, which I think was signed back in March. And basically, yeah, they would just say they were due to receive the final tranche under the amended on-demand. But, yeah, I mean, this whole inventory monetization thing, it was extremely complex back then, and it's still remains quite complicated right now, doesn't it, when you try and sit down and understand the technologies?
Yeah, and I mean, I think technology's moved on as well. So it's sort of, yeah, I mean, for all shareholders and for everybody who owns those 70 billion shares, let's hope it works out. But yeah. It certainly is a blast from the past, that's for sure.
Yeah, Eco buildings up 85% after they issued clarification regarding the operations in Chile. They obviously clarified also that the 12.75 million euro initial deposit received under the 420 million euro Chilean government housing contract covers 1,214 homes, not 607, as previously was stated in the first RNS. So a little bit of a clarification on that. And obviously that change reflects an accelerated delivery schedule approved by the Chilean housing authorities, increasing the number of homes to be completed in year one. So what do you make of that? I mean, they've had an incredible run, haven't they? If you look at Eco Buildings' performance over the last, I don't know, let's say 6 weeks. They're currently trading at 22 pence with a 25 million market cap. But I remember the days when they were around the 3-4 pence mark, and it wasn't that long ago.
No, it was crazy oversold then. It really was crazy oversold. But at the same time, nobody really saw the potential or what was going to happen. I had a meeting actually with the chairman, Chris, and one of my acquaintances, Billy, during the week, just really talking about the future and trying to create a system where they can go into other countries so that this can be almost like a humanitarian thing. But Eco Buildings is obviously going to benefit as well as whoever wants to put the money in. So yeah, it could be very interesting. I think if it's scaled up, this is going to be worth hundreds of millions, to be honest. So I think the price that it's at now is still pretty reasonable. If it works, it's going to be pretty tremendous, I think, to be
Yeah,
honest.
I think so. With a contract that size, it looks really, really exciting.
Yeah.
Metals One up 37 on the week. Mila Resources up 36%. Incantera up 35 to 36% as well. So a little bit of buying on that one. And we did talk a little bit at length, I think, at the end of last week's show on that one. So Bazan Resources up 18%, PYX up 17%, and Empyrean Energy up 16%. So some pretty good movers there on the week, mainly in the kind of like the commodities, the mining space. In terms of shakers, we've seen Polarian Imaging down 60%. They're the med tech company specializing in hyperpolarized xenon MRI lung imaging. They launched a strategic review to assess the future direction and structure amid a continued small cap market challenges. And the board obviously cited low liquidity, persistent undervaluation, and high listing costs as key factors, noting it is evaluating options to maximize shareholder value, including potentially delisting. So the big D word mentioned in the RNS, and obviously we saw a big sell-off on the Thursday. So 60% down on the week. Arc Minerals, go on,
Doesn't
Arc.
fill you with hope, that one, does it? I mean,
No.
more from the point of view that if they were working well, then I don't think they'd be talking about this. So
No.
that doesn't fill me with good. Arc Minerals, they had their news this week as well, didn't they? That was a
Yeah,
disaster.
55% down on the week. Obviously, they were higher, but there was a little bit of recovery. But I mean, what do you Mutual termination of the JV, as you say, with Anglo American regarding these Zambian copper tenements, with Anglo surrendering the interest and shares in this Handa Resources. So approximately $800,000 are going to remain in Handa's account as ARC resumes full control over those assets. The chairman, Nick von Schoending, said the company now regains control of one of Africa's most prospective copper assets and will consider new partnership options. He also added that ARC remains focused on resolving ongoing legal issues in Zambia, and with current cash reserves and funds retained in hand, it does not anticipate needing to raise equity in the near term. So, yeah, thoughts on that one? Bit of a shocker, but I guess these things happen, don't they? We saw it with Conroy when was it the Damirpol moved away from the JV as well, didn't they?
I mean, when we've been to Zambia and we've spoken to Zambian people on the ground who are in the know of this, they never really liked these assets. And that's what they were saying to us. And they didn't have any axe to grind, if you like. At the same time, Arc Minerals has basically been completely tied up. The court things tied them up. They've got extremely high ongoing costs because the staff are taking big wages and stuff as well. So I think they're in difficulties, to be honest with you. I mean, saying they don't have to raise in the near term, I think basically means we don't have to raise in the next 2 weeks,
Yeah,
not a year.
that's always a kind of
So I mean, it's not, when I compare it, and I was trying to do this in some of the groups this week, when I was comparing it to African Pioneer is like worth half of it, has its own license, has its own JORC resource, has licenses in Zambia, which are very good as well, and has a full mining license in Namibia. That doesn't make any sense to me. Like that you know, the value of African Pioneer or even Extract.
Yeah.
Bazant now is in a different ballpark because I think he's going to move forward and actually become a miner. Galileo, the same. You know, they've got mining licenses. You know, whereas ARC Minerals is still an explorer, and now it's had its main partner pull out, and basically it's going to have to finance itself or get another joint partner. So, yeah, I mean, again, people will not like what I'm saying, but I don't rate it, to be honest with you. And I haven't done all along.
No. Okay, the trade that could have been, I don't know if you saw this, but on, I think it was Wednesday evening into Thursday morning in the UK, we saw Makango Resources. They were up 300% on TSX Ventures, and then they had a halt. Management then issued a statement on the Thursday morning. But what a trade that could have been on the Thursday. You know, basically the management confirmed at the request of Chiro that management was unaware of any material changes to its operations that would explain the recent market activity. And obviously they're talking about the market activity on the previous day's trading in Toronto on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And I think the leak was not a leak, but there was news that they were going to do some sort of NASDAQ listing and some sort of merger with one of the companies that they were alongside. Now, I don't think it was Hypermag, but it was another company that has been touted to be working with them. But very interesting performance. And then obviously it moved up about, I think, like 15% on the Friday's trading. But it's interesting because they've got this Hypermag. It's this recycling of rare earth magnets and alloys. And have a look at their performance, Kev, just out of interest. Makango's one we've talked about in the past, but they're up 600% on the year. They've been creeping up. You know, it's one of those slow burners. They've done really, really well. Yeah, and they've also got the Songwe project in Malawi as well, which is really good to see another company with assets in Malawi as well, like obviously Sovereign have got.
No, I hadn't noticed that, to be honest, but yeah. What have you been up to all week anyway? Because you've been out and about. Yeah. I haven't been speaking to you.
Absolutely. So on Wednesday, I went for lunch with, I was invited up to B Hodl. So B Hodl are a Bitcoin treasury company. So I was invited to lunch with, it was a kind of like a lunch with the CEO, Freddie New, and the COO, Mike Crosby. Lovely guys, spent about an hour talking to them, and basically they gave a presentation. So B Hodl came to the Aquis market in September, and they're they're not a pure play Bitcoin treasury company, but they certainly have that as one of their major kind of like, you know, the first string to the bow. But what they've also got is something called the Lightning Network, which they're developing, which is effectively like a payment. It's a Bitcoin payment system where they're going to be using basically putting their Bitcoin treasury holdings onto this Lightning Network for liquidity. And I think they're holding around about 148 Bitcoin within the treasury. So came to market, raised about £15 million from memory, bought up quite a lot of the Bitcoin. So they're holding around the 150 mark now, and they're going to put that forward onto the Lightning Network to facilitate you know, Bitcoin payments much, much faster using this Lightning Network. And then they're obviously going to be able to get a yield of anywhere between 4% and 8% from these transactions and from providing the liquidity into this Lightning Network. So it looks actually really exciting. And I think there's they kind of rose when they came to market on the IPO. They moved up to about from 15p up to 20 pence, but they're now back around the 13.5-14. So they're currently trading around that, just slightly below their IPO level. So it looks really good. We're going to try and get them on the podcast, you know, 1 week, whether it be next week or within the next month, and let them sort of, you know, give retail investors the story, because ultimately, I don't think a lot of people really know the story. Obviously, we've talked about the Smarter Web Company, we've talked about London Bitcoin Company, we've obviously had Coincilium on in the past, we've looked at Amazing AI, but B Hodl is not one that's sort of been on our radar. So it was actually really nice to sort of hear about their tech.
Yeah, what do you think is going to happen to the Bitcoin things over the next few weeks?
Yeah, interesting. So Bitcoin pricing has obviously, it went up to the sort of 120 mark, 125, and then it dropped back off, didn't it, around sort of just above the 100, sort of call it the 105 mark. I think last time I checked, it was trading around, it tried to burst back up to sort of 115. And I think it's around the 110, 115 mark now. You might correct me if I'm wrong, 115.
Yeah, it's 110 at the moment.
Okay, so 110, okay. So I think that any movement up, so to take, for instance, Smarter Web Company, they're around the 65 pence mark, which is around one, I think 180 to 190 million market cap. Now, I was looking at the amount of Bitcoin that Smarter Web hold, which is somewhere around the region of about 200 million of Bitcoin. It's about 2,668 or something like that of Bitcoin, okay? So they are trading just ever so slightly below the NAV, 1M NAV, you know, they're about 1M NAV, okay? And I think if we see a movement back up in Bitcoin to the 125, 130, 135, which it should happen, let's face it, then we will see a massive correction in the Smarter Web Company. And a lot of it, and that will bring up, once we see this next, Coincilium will have another run. They've dropped back to the 4.5 pence mark. Any Bitcoin treasury play on the UK market, I think we'll see a lot of liquidity coming back in, and we'll see another spike in the price. Not spike, I don't like that word, but we'll see another surge in the performance of these companies.
Yeah, I think if you look at Bitcoin, by all accounts, we're in the fourth quarter of the fourth year, and this is always the time where Bitcoin goes a bit crazy. Right. If that happens, then it's going to allow these treasury companies to do the flywheel again,
yeah,
and raise and accumulate. That's why I'm very excited about Amazing AI as well. Amazing AI is going to be launching in the next week or two their first purchases, and they're going to be doing it not by buying the Bitcoin, but by doing the options, call and put options, which means immediately they should have literally thousands of Bitcoin in terms of what you're involved in. So they're going to have more than SWC probably within 3 or 4 months. But they're obviously not going to hold the physical Bitcoin.
Because they're leveraging effectively.
It's a huge leverage play. Now, if we do get what we're going to get, Amazing AI is going to go crazy. Coin is also one I like as well, simply because I think this whole yellow system, which is another sort of payment type system, which is what you're talking about with HODL, is the same thing. It's not the same thing, sorry, but it is another bow to the, or string to their bow, if you like, that should produce some income. But I think the stars of the next few months are going to be the resource plays, to be honest. I think there's plenty of resource plays out there that have been either missed, or they're going to have some fantastic news that's going to start pushing them, to far, far greater heights than they are at the minute. That's my view anyway, because I think, we've got gold at 4,100, and yes, it's pulled back a bit, but come on, if you'd asked anybody at the start of this year, would gold be at 4,000 now? Virtually nobody would have said it, okay? Silver has hit an all-time high as well, and we all know that you cannot buy the silver for the price that they're quoting it. It's not possible. You know, silver is $64 to $70 an ounce if you want to buy it. I mean, I saw you putting some stuff on about how much it was for a Britannia coin. I mean, how many pounds is it, including VAT?
Well, we looked at that, didn't we? I went onto the Royal Mint's website and just put in one. I only collect Britannia. I told you, Britannia's, Eagles, or Canadian Maple Leafs. I think they're the three best quality coins, whether you get them in silver or gold. That's what I look at, because they are the standard that you know as soon as you, if you wanted to resell them and take them to any, trader in any of these coins on the high street, or if you put them on eBay or Facebook or wherever you want to market them, someone will want to snap your hand off for one of those coins. They are not numismatic, they are the best coins anyway. And we were looking at putting in a 2026 silver Britannia, and it was £50 pretty much on the nose, but then there was the investment VAT on top of it, which was another tenner, then the shipping. So I think we worked it out, Kev. It was £62 for one coin delivered, and you said it, we'll look at that in dollars, and we're looking at what, $73, $74 or something?
62 times 1.34 is $83.
There you go. $83 a coin. And, you know, we look at these future prices, and they're nothing, like, they're not the physical prices. They're just the, they're the COMEX prices, aren't they? That's what's being traded.
Yeah, no, they're absolutely nuts. And that just shows you
how manipulated it is. I mean, even in China, there's backwardation going on because their spot price is higher as well. And in a way, that also is not the quality of physical gold that they're actually selling as well. You know, that's just, I mean, there was a podcast I listened to, and it said that the amount of silver that was traded on one day in the COMEX when it was all going a bit crazy was the same amount of silver that is produced in the entire year.
Crazy.
On one day. And every contract for silver on the COMEX was 490 times traded in digital.
Yeah. Did you see the gold to silver ratio through history with like Menes 3200 BC 1-3, Egypt 2700 BC, 1-9, Spain 1497 1-10, and then with Trump it just shows a picture of a clown in charge 1-88. I don't know if you saw it, but it was a great little meme that was put on.
But and did you see the loan situation that's happened in India this week? So what India has done is actually put in a gold and silver standard that you can borrow against your silver and against your gold. And have a guess what ratio they've used.
Go on.
1-10.
Wow.
Can you imagine? If that was the case right now, silver's $410 an ounce.
I love that meme as well, the one with Matthew McConaughey. It says gold, the top picture shows him smiling, and the Lincoln lawyer is like with his hands on his mouth saying gold at 4100 ounces at 13th of October, smiley face. Picture at the bottom, gold at 4100 ounces on 22nd of October, and he's crying, he's in Dallas Buyers Club and he's like in tears, it's absolutely genius. In other words, you looked at it last, a week ago, and you were happy at 4100, but then because it's been up to 4445 and it's now dropped to 4100 a week later, everyone's crying saying gold's falling, it's like that shares, isn't it? It's the same emotions that happen with shares.
Yeah, but that price is being manipulated because everybody I speak to is like, what do you think about gold and silver? What do you think about gold and silver? Should I buy some? My friend came and actually bought some silver from me, so because it can't be delivered, and he wanted it for his father-in-law. So I sold him it, and I'm now going to go and order it again and wait 3 or 4 weeks. Because people are just like, oh, now's the time. Yeah. 9 months ago.
The problem is when mates and taxi drivers, as we always said, are starting to buy it, like who never would get into it, that's always a bit of a red flag for me. You know what I mean? It's like, I get what you're saying. It's people, there is a hysteria, and you could argue it is it's driving demand. And obviously, like you try ordering now any coins from, as you say, the mint in the UK, and there's a 3 week wait. Some of it's not even available. They've pulled some coins. So ultimately there, but I just think when you get to this hysteria, you think to yourself, now's the time to probably be trimming some of it down. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't
think so with silver. I think silver hasn't.
Oh, no, I'm almost of that, like the HODL vibe for me is I was buying it. I've been buying it for the last 5 years. I was buying it when silver was around the $19, $20 mark. I don't see any point in getting rid of it. I genuinely see it going. It's almost like a Bitcoin thing. I just want to hold it for because I want it.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I've certainly ran this bit for as an investment, so that I can make some money. But I'd happily take all my money back out and hold what I've got left, if you know, which hopefully is going to be sort of half and half, if you like. So, but we'll see. But I mean, again, the whole point behind this is resources aren't going away, right? No. They're physical things. And those physical things are what is going to have value because we have a US dollar, which is effectively being devalued. We have a yuan in terms of the Chinese currency, which is collecting gold so it can be the main currency of the world, as far as I can see. It's going to be backed by gold again. And that's where we're headed. Will Bitcoin play a role? Yes. Will gold play a role? Yes. Will silver play a role? Yes.
Definitely.
Will copper become more valuable? Yes. Will all of the precious metals, palladium and et cetera, play a role? Yes. Will our
assets that are valued in dollars become more valuable, possibly depending on where they are in the world, but actually they could just maintain their value. So your $3 million house now might still be worth $3 million in 5 years, but it will be half of its value.
Yeah. I think if we look at just a bit more of the wider markets, obviously on Thursday, we saw the FTSE 100 reach a new all-time high, intraday high of about 9,594, surpassing its previous peak from obviously earlier in the month. And then on it actually finished the week at 96.45, which is just incredible. What an amazing run the FTSE has had in the last year. Obviously, we saw even the US markets finished, I think we said to you, every single market around the world finished green that I could see on Friday. Dow was up, S&P was up, Nikkei was up, Hang Seng was up. So very, very good performance on the markets, which doesn't kind of reflect what's going on in the wider, with all the tariffs. And, obviously we saw massive inflation, UK inflation held at 3.8% in September. Get your head around that. Food price rises, obviously finally slowing for the first time since March. But that core rate dipped to 3.5%. There was a little bit of relief ahead of the budget. But I think inflation does remain nearly double the Bank of England's 2% target. So what does that say about the cost of living?
Yeah, well, we know it's going up, don't we? But what I would say to you about the FTSE, right? Because when I was in the markets in the early 2000s, late 1990s, okay, the DAX was the same as the FTSE, okay? And then the DAX started to take over. Now, the DAX today is 24,232 or 239, and the FTSE is 9,600. 25 years ago, roughly, they were the same.
Yeah, makes sense. So, so if you look at the best performer on the FTSE 100 year to date, it's actually Fresnillo, the silver producer, who are up 251% since January. So amazing performance there. And then I think Endeavour Mining are the next one in that league. They're up about 120%. So not about half the amount that Fres are up. So really good performance there. But I think we've talked long enough. Great to have two guests on, Callum and Colin, come back to give us an update, et cetera. And and I think we'll say, obviously, thanks for listening all. If you do like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for any future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend all. And don't forget to put your clocks back.
Indeed. Chill and extract. Enjoy.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net